compared to funders like the Walton Family Foundation, which gave out more money for education reform in 2014 alone than the Arnold Foundation did in 5 years. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation is another giant player in this area, along with the Broad Foundation. All these foundations came to K through 12 with a similar goal: to bring about large-scale changes in America's public education system. Nowhere have philanthropists taken a more muscular approach to influencing public life than in education, and nowhere have they stirred more fears that philanthropy is becoming yet another tool for the wealthy to speak more loudly than anyone else. Those fears are understandable. Funders have worked to reshape education in the past decade at multiple levels, with their influence reaching from Washington, D.C., to the new charter school down the street from you. Yet this crusade, marked by record levels of spending, also underscores the limits of philanthropic power. The new givers have made a lot of noise on K-12, the Vergara lawsuit in California being a good example, but it's not clear they've actually done much to improve outcomes for the vast majority of U.S. students. America's public school system has famously been a graveyard for ambitious philanthropists. A first challenge is scale. As a $600 billion complex enrolling 50 million students, the K-12 system is hard for philanthropists to sway, given their comparatively limited resources. A second is decentralization. There are over 13,000 public school districts across the United States, and a victory in one city or state doesn't necessarily translate into gains elsewhere. The philanthropist most famously humbled by education was the newspaper magnate Walter Annenberg, who gave $500 million to finance K-12 reform efforts in the 1990s. That effort channeled money to local groups trying to fix schools and was widely judged to have failed. For the funders who came next, like Gates, Broad, and the Waltons, a key takeaway from Annenberg's venture was that philanthropists needed to be more hands-on in orchestrating school reform, to ensure that their own vision of innovation wasn't compromised. "We didn't want to do what Walter Annenberg did," Eli Broad told me. "You can't just write a check and throw money at it." A key trait of the new wave of education reform funders has been their muscular approach. Reform philanthropists have sought to change outcomes within this sprawling system by focusing on several leverage points, and along the way, they have generated enormous backlash from critics who see these donors as usurping citizen control of public schools. One of the biggest ventures of education funders in recent years has been to create the Common Core State Standards, with the goal of bringing sweeping changes in how children are taught. In 2008, Bill and Melinda Gates were sold on the idea of raising the bar for U.S. education achievement through uniform standards. By this time, the Gateses had already given billions to improve U.S. education, backing reforms that often created wide disruption in school districts while yielding mediocre results. Bill Gates sees education as the primary building block for equal opportunity. The issue has animated him since his earliest days of large-scale philanthropy. He's also found education maddening in ways that his foundation's global grant-making is not. Partly, his frustration is with the constraints imposed by democratic systems. "For me, the most disappointing thing is that the work can go backwards," Gates once said. "In other areas where we work, if we come up with a new malaria drug or malaria vaccine, nobody votes to uninvent our malaria vaccine, so it's pretty steady progress. Education is different because of its complexity, its political nature, the relationship between management and labor." The Gates Foundation is often viewed as a 900-pound gorilla on the K-12 scene, bulldozing forward with ideas that have sometimes turned out to be half-baked. Critics see the foundation as wielding way too much power and in way too cavalier a fashion. Unsurprisingly, Bill Gates takes a wonkier view of his role in education, which he describes as financing the research and experimentation needed to improve schools. When he was building Microsoft, Gates put a huge emphasis on R&D, to the point that Microsoft came to outspend nearly every corporation in the world in this area. In 2013 alone, Microsoft spent $10.3 billion on R&D. Gates has also been a huge champion of government spending for research in fields like medicine and energy, which in recent years has totaled tens of billions of dollars annually. Meanwhile, though, Gates notes that funding of what works in education is tiny. The R&D percentage is the lowest in this field of any field of human endeavor, yet you could argue it should be the highest because this field is catalytic. That's where Gates sees his foundation coming in. Playing what he has called a technocratic role in testing what works to improve education and to create more options for public officials. Gates views this as one of the best ways to leverage K-12 philanthropic dollars. Among the foundation's most ambitious research efforts in the past decade has been investing hundreds of millions of dollars to determine what makes an effective teacher. This hugely critical question, it turned out, had never been answered in a rigorous way. The Gates Project included analyzing videos of 13,000 lessons taught by some 3,000 elementary school teachers. In public interviews, Gates plays up his foundation's R&D role and has denied that it is a political player. In fact, the foundation has often shaped policy in public school districts and in the nation as a whole. A case in point is its promotion of the Common Core state standards. That work got underway in the summer of 2008 after Bill and Melinda listened to a pitch for national standards from Gene Wilhoit, director of a national group of state school chiefs, and David Coleman, an education consultant. According to a later account by the Washington Post, Coleman and Wilhoit told the Gateses that academic standards varied so wildly between states that high school diplomas had lost all meaning, that as many as 40% of college freshmen needed remedial classes, and that U.S. students were falling behind their foreign competitors. In other ways, too, the U.S. education system was a fragmented mess. The solution? To get all 50 U.S. states to embrace a common set of education standards, along with ways to assess teacher and student performance. In many other advanced countries, the idea that all students should learn the same things in the same way isn't controversial. Places like France have centralized education systems run by the national government. Not so the United States, which has favored more local control of schools and a diversity of approaches to education. The standards that Coleman and Wilhoit were proposing to Gates wouldn't be dictated by Washington, the way that Paris tells every school in France how to operate. Rather, the idea was to develop a single set of standards that each state would voluntarily embrace, hopefully sidestepping any firestorm about a federal takeover of education, but achieving a similar result. After thinking about the pitch from Coleman and Wilhoit for a few weeks, the Gateses decided to get behind their idea in a big way, mobilizing the full resources of the foundation to help create and sell what became the Common Core state standards. The Gates Foundation is a colossus, at least in the world of philanthropy. It employs some 1,400 people, many working out of a modern headquarters in downtown Seattle that the couple financed with a one-time gift of $350 million, and which opened in 2011, across the street from the Space Needle. The foundation spends nearly four times as much every year as the next largest foundation in the United States. Most of its grant-making is focused overseas, but it gives over $500 million annually for education in this country, with most of that going to improve K-12. Just for perspective, though, this is about as much money as the New York City public school system spends in a week. If the Gates Foundation were a corporation, it wouldn't make the Fortune 500 list. Back in his old life heading Microsoft, Gates commanded one of the biggest tech companies in the world, with over 60,000 employees. And while nonprofit types often view the Gates Foundation as mammoth, the Gateses themselves are keenly aware of just how limited their resources are compared to the problems they are tackling. Gates has called the spending by himself and other education philanthropists truly a rounding error in the grander scheme of things. Critics of education funders dismiss such humble claims as a smokescreen designed to obscure the real facts of just how much influence private money can buy in a public system, especially when it's strategically spent. The Common Core offers evidence for both the power and the limits of philanthropists. In pushing Common Core, the Gates Foundation pulled every lever it could think of, ultimately giving out several $100 million in grants to a vast array of players who helped advance and implement the program, from associations of state officials to think tanks on both left and right to the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. Gates' money also flowed during this period to the two top teachers' unions. Over time, it became hard to think of many education groups that weren't getting Gates' money. As one reporter commented, "Sooner or later, everyone works for Gates," a situation that's not exactly conducive to honest debate about the foundation's ideas. Jay Green, an education scholar at the University of Arkansas, put the problem this way. "Really rich guys can come up with ideas that they think are great, but there is a danger that everyone will tell them they're great, even if they're not." By late 2010, 45 states had adopted the Common Core, before the standards were even fully developed, with full implementation unfolding over subsequent years. This work was backed by a range of other foundations, such as Hewlett and Broad, but the lion's share of the credit for the initiative's adoption goes to Gates, a stunning victory for the foundation that, in a way, is hard to get one's mind around. In effect, Bill and Melinda Gates, two private individuals, have helped determine what tens of millions of American children in public schools will learn every year, and also how they will learn with changes in the teaching of math and other subjects. Less clear, though, is what effect the Common Core will ultimately have. While there is no question about the power that private money has played in ushering in the Common Core standards, experts remain divided as to whether they will actually do much to raise student achievement, and definitive answers to this question are unlikely to emerge for many years. Gates' money may have changed policies and practices, but that's not the same as changing outcomes. Charter schools are another area where private philanthropists have wielded enormous power over public life, with uncertain results to date. Funders from the business world, like Bill Ackman, have viewed charter schools as the hot startups that would smash the public K-12 monopoly, forcing all failing schools to improve, just as market theory might predict. In this sense, bankrolling charters was seen as a highly leveraged investment, the kind of well-targeted philanthropy that would produce systemic change. Things haven't worked out that way. Having charter schools in a city doesn't necessarily exert pressures on traditional schools to improve. It can even hurt such schools by draining away resources and students. Meanwhile, charters have proved hard to scale. By 2016, after billions of dollars in philanthropic outlays, just 5% of U.S. students were in charter schools. In some cities, with high concentrations of poor kids, that number is much higher, and charters have truly scaled in some places. But overall, this reform is far from ever reaching a significant percentage of K-12 students. Giving for charters has turned out to be more akin to funding direct services than instigating a revolution in American education. In 2015, the Walton Family Foundation, the biggest charter champion of all, put out a new strategic plan that acknowledged that more competition wasn't delivering the change it had hoped for. The foundation said its theory of change has evolved, choice is necessary, but schools of choice cannot stimulate systemic transformation and large-scale improvements on their own. Walton's proposed solution was to invest more heavily in trying to create environments that support choice, an effort that entailed even more aggressive efforts to shape local school policies. As charter funders absorbed hard-learned lessons, they began to concentrate resources more strategically in a handful of key cities to increase the number of poor kids attending charters. Maybe charters couldn't produce systemic change, and maybe they were hard to scale nationally, but if funders could remake the systems of just those cities that contained the most poverty and the worst schools, that could make a huge difference. Or so went the thinking. This strategy entailed marshaling serious muscle to overcome the opponents of more charters in target cities. Philanthropic spending was one tool, but campaign spending was another, as donors funneled electoral cash to pro-charter public officials and candidates in places like Los Angeles. In Washington state, a group of deep-pocketed donors, including Bill Gates, Alice Walton, Reed Hastings, and Connie Ballmer, gave millions of dollars to help narrowly pass a ballot initiative in 2012 authorizing charter schools. It was later struck down by the Washington Supreme Court. In New York, a small group of hedge fund billionaires poured some $10 million into campaign donations and lobbying in 2014 aimed at expanding charter schools in New York City. Across the river, in New Jersey, two wealthy hedge funders, David Tepper and Alan Fournier, created a PAC to influence state education policy, while also making steady philanthropic gifts aimed at boosting K-12 schools. Just to the north, in Connecticut, the hedge fund billionaire Stephen Mandel contributed heavily to elect a charter-friendly Democratic governor, Daniel Malloy, in 2010, and then gave charitable grants to nonprofits that backed a Malloy education plan that channeled more money to charters. Later, it was reported that one of Mandel's foundations was paying three fellows working on policy matters in Malloy's office and two state departments. Thanks to Mark Zuckerberg's involvement, the troubled reform bid in Newark became a famous example of philanthropists focusing huge resources on a select number of high-poverty urban school districts. In fact, though, Washington, D.C., has attracted more money from funders per student than any other U.S. city. The nation's capital became a top battleground for education funders in 2007, after Mayor Adrian Fenty appointed Michelle Rhee chancellor of the D.C. public schools. Rhee didn't just push charters. She rammed through a new teacher evaluation system that gave big bonuses for top teachers and penalized or fired ineffective ones. A group of foundations led by Walton and Broad helped shoulder the costs of the system to the tune of nearly $65 million. The retired billionaire hedge funder, Julian Robertson, also gave big to help Rhee. Rhee's reign in Washington was highly controversial, and she was out of office by 2010, after Fenty was defeated in his re-election bid, in part because of criticism of Rhee. Still, her legacy lived on. In 2014 to 2015, nearly half of D.C. school kids were enrolled in public charter schools. Rhee went on to found the reform group Students First, with startup funds from the Arnold and Broad Foundations, among other donors. In 14 other cities, including some of the poorest in the country, Gary, Indiana, and Flint, Michigan, 30% or more of students were enrolled in charter schools. In New Orleans, which the Arnolds and other funders embraced as a top proving ground of charters, 93% of students were in such schools. Just over half of Detroit's students now attend charters. In other words, the strategic choice of funders to push hard in certain places is paying off. Charters may not be sweeping the entire education system, but they are greatly expanding choice in many poor cities. It's hard to generalize about the effects of all these new charter schools on the students who attend them. Such impact is fiercely debated, with the jury still out in many cities, like Detroit, that remain in the throes of disruptive change. The only thing that's really clear is that compared to the systemic revolution that charter funders were hoping for, The results have been disappointing. Such schools haven't yet been the levers for broader change that many had imagined. Still, donors like the Walton family and Eli Brode aren't giving up. They've lately doubled down on charters and, with billions more to give, are ready for a long slog. "It's the toughest area," Brode told me. Other top ed philanthropists, like Mark Zuckerberg and Priscilla Chan, are looking beyond the mantras of choice and accountability. The couple is now investing their greatest hopes in personalized learning, which Zuckerberg has described as a way for teachers work with students to customize instruction to meet the students' individual needs and interests. Chan told me, "The charter numbers are great, but at the end of the day, we realize that a lot of kids are in district schools. We want to work with the people who are serving all those kids, too. We don't want to work for a few special activated families or families that happen to be near charter schools. We want to be able to reach all kids. And to do that, we need to be able to work with the current system and new systems." Philanthropists may be the new social engineers of our time, but their efforts to orchestrate large-scale changes in society don't tend to attract much attention. Even your average reader of the New York Times probably can't name more than several of America's biggest donors, much less say what they're doing. Many philanthropists like it this way, working in the background to try to reorder American life without anyone knowing their names or how powerful they really are. And while the media heavily covers the role of money in electoral campaigns, it rarely looks at how philanthropic dollars shape policy. Education giving has been different. The role of these funders has drawn wide scrutiny, in part because some are so famous. Gates is well known because of his wealth, while the Walton family is known because of Walmart. The hedge fund industry, which has produced many billionaire education reform donors, is a high-profile lightning rod for criticisms of inequality. In a populist age, with distrust of the wealthy growing, the new education philanthropists have taken withering fire for interfering with the proper workings of democracy. Diane Ravitch, a scholar who once aligned herself with reformers before she emerged as their fiercest critic, has warned about the undue influence of a billionaire boys' club that has decided that they know how to fix public education. About Gates and the Common Core, Ravitch said, "The idea that the richest man in America can purchase and, working closely with the U.S. Department of Education, impose new and untested academic standards on the nation's public schools is a national scandal. A congressional investigation is warranted." Perhaps, needless to say, there's been no investigation. It's rare for Congress to ask hard questions about how private philanthropy is influencing public policy. The last time it really did so was in the 1960s, when a populist congressman from Texas, Wright Patman, made it his business to probe what he saw as foundation misconduct in a series of hard-hitting reports. In 1969, foundation leaders, including Ford President McGeorge Bundy, were grilled by the House Ways and Means Committee on whether, as tax-exempt nonprofits, they had violated the law with their activist funding. Since then, little has been heard on Capitol Hill about the overreach of philanthropy in democratic life. But lately, alarm about the growing influence of private donors in K-12 has spread beyond critics on the left to include some on the right, who share the view that Gates orchestrated the backdoor nationalization of education standards through the Common Core, working in concert with the Obama administration to achieve a longtime dream of liberals. By the 2016 election, the conservative backlash to the Common Core had become so intense that it emerged as a major litmus test among GOP primary voters. Various wealthy philanthropists on the right, like the hedge funder Sean Feiler, stepped up to fight the initiative by backing grassroots activism nationwide that galvanized many Tea Party supporters. In a rare media interview in 2014, in which he was pressed on his outsized influence in education policy, Bill Gates defended his foundation's role, reiterating his usual point that its work is aimed at expanding the pool of ideas available to policymakers, not to tell those officials what to do. He said, "Our voice is not there when the final choice of what to scale up is made. That's a governor or a superintendent or board of education that decide those things." Bill Gates is not the first technocratic philanthropist to plead dumb when it comes to his or her political clout. The poise of expert neutrality has long been common across the foundation world, but if Gates is reluctant to admit his power over education policy, everyone else gets it. Gates is widely viewed as among the most influential people in education. One 2006 study ranked him as the most influential person, ahead of President George W. Bush. Gates is also not the only mega-giver to defend himself by saying that he is expanding the scope of public debate, not narrowing it. The new large-scale giving, say Gates and others, is not a subversion of the Tocquevillian pluralist ideal, but rather an expression of it, because the funds go to amplify many more voices and ideas so that they can inform policy deliberations. Whether you think Gates is right or wrong on this point probably has a lot to do with how you feel about what he and his foundation have been up to. When donors hold views we detest, we tend to see them as unfairly tilting policy debates with their money. Yet, when we like their causes, we often view them as heroically stepping forward to level the playing field against powerful special interests or backward public majorities. These sort of a la carte reactions don't make a lot of sense. Really, the question should be whether we think it's okay overall for any philanthropists to have so much power to advance their own vision of a better society. Chapter 7. Advocates. Not every big-time philanthropist these days is out to disrupt existing systems with fancy strategies or breakthrough concepts. Many just want to have an impact, however they can, and will readily turn to old and familiar tools to get the job done. They see making change not as rocket science, but as an exercise in persistence and steady, high-level giving. The ideological think tank funders we met earlier in the book are a case in point. They're pouring money into a proven strategy that's been used for decades to sway policy. Often, such think tanks don't advance many new ideas, but rather just bang the drum for old ones, with a few tweaks and updates. Right-wing wonks have pushed for privatizing Social Security for 30 years. The left's policy shops have been calling for a higher minimum wage for just as long. And lately, amid an influx of new cash, the tempo of all these familiar battles has been increasing. Likewise, big philanthropy has meant boom times for traditional advocacy groups working such beats as the environment, LGBT rights, abortion, and guns. Nonprofits that have been around for decades, like the Sierra Club, the ACLU, Planned Parenthood, and the NRA, have pulled in record money in recent years as legions of new upper-class donors have mobilized to press their views in the public square. The tug of war around some hot-button issues can be grueling as advocates tap large donor bases to blast away at one another year after year without much movement on policy. Abortion is a prime example. Philanthropists on both sides of that issue give millions and millions annually, to be rewarded only with modest incremental gains. Pro-life advocates have managed over decades to make it harder to get clinic abortions in many states, while pro-choice forces have greatly expanded access to medical abortion drugs. Big turning point moments, such as when the U.S. Supreme Court struck down Texas's restrictive anti-abortion law in 2016, have tended to be few and far between. Public opinion on abortion hasn't changed much in a generation, despite various well-financed PR and messaging pushes by both sides. On other issues, though, it's been a very different story, with wealthy donors bankrolling advocacy efforts that yield big shifts in public policy. The war on coal. Climate change is one area where deep-pocketed philanthropists have lately had a big influence by bankrolling advocacy, with Michael Bloomberg near the forefront of this push. After the Bush administration rejected the Kyoto Protocol in 2005, then-Mayor Bloomberg joined a coalition of mayors who pledged to curb greenhouse gases at the local level. The following year, in a commencement speech at Johns Hopkins, he slammed those blocking action on climate change. Despite near unanimity in the science community, there's now a movement driven by ideology and short-term economics to ignore the evidence and discredit the reality of climate change. During his second term as mayor, Bloomberg unveiled an ambitious plan to reduce the city's greenhouse gas emissions, and later became chairman of a group of mayors from major cities around the world fighting climate change. In 2010, early in his third term, Bloomberg was looking to step up his philanthropy even as he spent his days governing Gotham. His fortune had soared during his years in office, as Bloomberg terminals proliferated ever more widely, and he had plenty of cash to spare for sideline pursuits. Bloomberg strongly considered a big push into education reform and asked his longtime advisor, Kevin Sheekey, to bring him ideas in that area. At a meeting at Gracie Mansion, Sheekey floated an education idea that didn't go over well. "It was a terrible meeting in every way, and Mike was angry," Sheekey later told Politico. "I said, 'Look, if you don't like this idea, that's fine. We'll bring you another.' He said, 'No, I want another now.'" Before the meeting, Sheekey had eaten lunch with Carl Pope, the head of the Sierra Club, who was starting a push to raise $50 million to expand the club's Beyond Coal campaign, which worked at the state and local level to shut down coal plants across the country. At the time, the campaign was only operating in 15 states. Pope wanted to expand the effort to 45 states. He saw this as a way to make progress on climate change, even as efforts to pass a cap-and-trade bill were fizzling in Congress. But Pope also told Sheekey that closing coal plants could have a big impact on public health by lowering the number of deaths from air pollution. In other words, the Beyond Coal campaign aimed to advance not one, but two of Bloomberg's passions. Bloomberg was sold on the idea of getting behind the campaign. "We'll just give Carl a check for the $50 million, he said. "Tell him to stop fundraising and get to work." It didn't turn out to be that simple. Naturally, Bloomberg wanted metrics and data so that he could gauge the progress of the Sierra Club's work. He wanted detailed indicators to guide the effort, analyzing coal plants across the country. He put us through the ringer, a Sierra Club executive said later. But thanks to Bloomberg's prodding, the group would go on to build a comprehensive database that tracked the retirement of coal plants and the gains from such closures in terms of public health and reduced carbon emissions. Bloomberg's massive donation to the club, the biggest in its history, was announced in 2011 at a press event before a coal power plant on the Potomac River. 5 years later, that plant was closed, and the Sierra Club was also taking credit for helping close an additional 232 coal plants. This success was accomplished largely through aggressive litigation work, with the club's lawyers using every strategy they could think of to shutter plants. Bloomberg's office received monthly reports on the work. In 2015, Bloomberg dramatically upped his investment in Beyond Coal, committing another $30 million. With that money in the pipeline, the campaign set a new, more ambitious goal: to retire by 2017 half of all coal-fired power plants that had been in operation in 2010, a goal that Bloomberg would describe as once almost unthinkable. Many millions of dollars had helped make it now nearly inevitable. In announcing this latest gift, Bloomberg called Beyond Coal one of the most successful grassroots environmental efforts in this country's history. That was something of a stretch, calling Beyond Coal a grassroots effort, since it was financed by a Manhattan billionaire, run by sophisticated advocates, and heavily staffed by lawyers. To the average coal miner in West Virginia, the effort might look like the very epitome of an elitist cabal. On the other hand, the director of Beyond Coal, Mary Hitt, had herself spent many years in Appalachia with a grassroots group called Appalachian Voices that worked on the front lines to curb the damage to humans and the environment caused by coal mining, including the horrendous practice of obliterating entire mountaintops. For decades, activists like Hitt had worked with limited success to challenge big coal, a powerful industry with clout at both the state and national level. Even as the industry took hits from the rise of natural gas in the early 2000s, it remained a major force, employing tens of thousands of people and devoting millions to campaign contributions and lobbying. Coal production actually hit an all-time high in 2008. Utility companies were also big coal boosters, looking to protect huge investments in generating plants that were designed to run on coal. Quite apart from its effects on the climate, though, coal is bad news. It releases toxic particulates into the air when burned. A 2011 report by the American Lung Association estimated that such pollution accounted for 13,000 deaths a year, as well as huge numbers of cases of asthma and other respiratory problems like emphysema. But the damage to human health went even further. As another report stated, coal pollutants affect all major body organ systems and contribute to four of the five leading causes of mortality in the U.S., heart disease, cancer, stroke, and chronic lower respiratory diseases. This was a high price for Americans to pay for relying on coal to generate electricity. But it was also a price widely dispersed across the country, given how coal pollution traveled in the air. That made it hard to organize those who suffered from coal. Many people didn't even know that coal pollution was to blame for their health problems or the deaths of loved ones. In contrast, those people who worked in the coal or power industries, from the miners to the truck drivers and up to the executives, were very aware of the critical role this fuel played in their lives. As a result, they were easily marshaled into a potent political force. The scholar Menker Olson would call this a collective action problem. As he described in his classic 1965 book, The Logic of Collective Action, large and disorganized groups of citizens have a hard time coming together to take action to advance their common interests. They are routinely bested in political combat by much smaller but better organized groups who are ready to fight fiercely and with laser focus. There are lots of examples of this in American life, beyond coal, like the way that gun owners band together through the NRA in opposition to gun regulations that most Americans favor, but with far less intensity. Or how teachers' unions are highly organized when it comes to defending job protections like last in, first out, policies that the public is only dimly familiar with. Or the way that the finance industry will fight much harder for looser rules on derivatives than ordinary people. Most of whom don't know what derivatives are will fight to impose such rules. Collective action problems help explain any number of frustrating aspects of America's democracy. Again and again, it's hard to solve obvious problems because organized interest groups can thwart the broader will of the public. Philanthropists can play a key role in overcoming such deadlocks. By writing checks and more, they can enable advocates to bypass the grueling and perhaps impossible work of rallying enough citizens to overcome narrow interest groups. This is one reason why philanthropy has been called society's passing gear. It speeds along changes that otherwise might take much longer or might never happen at all. One obvious question, though, is whether it's okay that wealthy donors and foundations are the ones deciding when and where to use that passing gear. Also, What happens when things accelerate too quickly, without enough careful thought? The answer, as we've seen, is that philanthropists applying the passing gear can end up in a ditch, which is what happened in Newark when Mark Zuckerberg and other funders backed disruptive education reforms without buy-in from the community. An even darker side of this picture is that the same advocacy tools that can engineer breakthroughs on behalf of the public interest can also be deployed by philanthropists to thwart the public interest. Indeed, who's to say what the public interest really is anyway? Better tools, bigger checks. These questions are growing more pressing as funders become savvier and more aggressive about influencing policy. Also, many more wealthy people are now engaged in such activist philanthropy than in the past, and richer ones too. The total amount of money in play has lately exploded. Green giving is a great example of this shift. 15 years ago, Michael Bloomberg's net worth was a fraction of what it is today, and he didn't give any of it to environmental causes. Now, he's one of the richest men on the planet and among the biggest backers of climate change advocacy. Bloomberg isn't just bringing his money to this fight. He's bringing decades of experience in business and government and a global network of powerful contacts. In turn, Bloomberg is just one of the new environmental mega-donors who had emerged in recent years and begun pouring money into large-scale advocacy. The former hedge fund manager Tom Steyer has drawn wide attention for his giving to curb climate change, much of it to his super PAC, Next Gen Climate. 10 years ago, Steyer's pockets weren't nearly as deep as they are today, and he was still immersed in building his San Francisco-based hedge fund. Thanks to shrewd bets in distressed assets, his fortune surged after the 2008 financial crisis, catapulting him onto the Forbes 400 list and ensuring he had ample money to play the influence game. After Steyer retired from his firm in 2012, he also had the time for such activism. Nat Simons is another green philanthropist who's tapped a fast-growing pile of hedge fund wealth to become a major new force in environmental giving. Nat is the son of Jim Simons, the mathematician and hedge fund pioneer who made billions in the markets, a fortune that tripled between 2005 and 2015, soaring to over $15 billion, creating plenty of spare cash to fuel family philanthropy. Nat also works in finance, having joined his father's firm, Renaissance Technologies, in the mid-1990s, after getting his master's in mathematics from the University of California at Berkeley. He spent 13 years there before spinning off his own hedge fund, the Meritage Group, which is based in San Francisco. While the older Simons has become very visible with his ambitious science giving, which will be discussed later, Nat operates very much in the background. In 2006, he and his wife, Laura Baxter Simons, created a foundation called Sea Change, which has a small staff but little presence online. The couple are its only trustees. Among climate advocates, Simons and Sea Change are well known. During the push to pass cap and trade legislation in 2009, the foundation wrote big checks to the top players in that battle, including the Environmental Defense Fund, the Natural Resources Defense Council, NRDC, and the Sierra Club. After the legislation failed, Sea Change kept up its spending. In just 1 3-year period, 2011 to 2013, the foundation made around $140 million in grants, with much of that money going to bankroll climate advocacy. Its biggest grants during that period went to the Partnership Project, an outfit started in 1999 to help unify America's top environmental groups so that they can have more impact. Other large seven-figure grants went to top environmental groups, as well as the Center for American Progress, the liberal think tank, which pushes climate-friendly policies inside the Beltway. Nat Simons is one of the single largest donors to environmental causes in the past decade. But he's rarely granted media interviews and seldom speaks in public, keeping a low profile that underscores how today's big philanthropy can feel shadowy and, to some, conspiratorial. Breitbart.com, the conservative news network, has attacked Simons for waging war on affordable energy by funding hard-left environmental causes. The Washington Free Beacon has charged that he profits financially from his philanthropy by investing in clean technologies, and even criticized him as a hypocrite for commuting to work on a powerboat. Such attacks on donors who fund in contested territory aren't unusual, with critics often alleging that financial self-interest is the real motive for giving. This is exactly why some donors choose to stay in the shadows, along with not wanting supplicants to line up at their door. For his part, Simons has described what he's up to in simple terms. Like other funders, he sees his giving as a way to speed up the pace of change toward a desirable, if not inevitable, future. He's said, "It's not really a question of whether we move to a low-carbon economy. I think it's clear we're moving there. The question is how quickly. The role of philanthropy is really to facilitate that process. It's not going to be ramming something down the throats of certain people. We know that's not going to work." Nat Simons' sister, Liz, also has a foundation bankrolled with their dad's hedge fund winnings, which she runs with her husband, Mark Heising. This couple, too, gives heavily for advocacy on climate change, although their interests range more widely to include science and education. Liz worked as a bilingual teacher in Oakland after getting her master's in education from Stanford. Mark trained as a computer scientist and worked in tech before going into finance. Like her brother, Liz doesn't shrink from policy combat. In early 2015, the Heising Simons Foundation teamed up with Bloomberg Philanthropies to lay out $48 million to help boost the Obama administration's ambitious effort to regulate greenhouse gas emissions at the state level. Operating through executive action, the administration was using the muscle of the Environmental Protection Agency, EPA, to push states toward renewable energy sources. The effort set off a furious backlash by Republican state officials, a backlash that funders like Bloomberg and Heising Simons sought to counter by strengthening environmental advocates working in different states. In other words, a president who made an end run around Congress got critical backup from wealthy philanthropists elected by no one. The Environmental Defense Fund was among the green groups that plunged into the running state battles over the EPA rules. EDF has been among the top grantees of the Heising Simons Foundation in recent years, but has pulled in even bigger bucks from other funders, including many on Wall Street. EDF's funding has soared as big new donors have taken up environmental issues and existing ones have upped their giving. In 2010, the group had $64 million in revenue. 2 years later, in 2012, that figure was up to $116 million. In 2014, it brought in $149 million, and it did nearly as well in 2015. Who's giving all that money? It's hard to say, because EDF is not transparent about its funding. One of its biggest donors, though, is Julian Robertson, a retired hedge fund billionaire who's given EDF tens of millions of dollars, including around $33 million over just 2 years, 2013 and 2014. Among environmental groups, EDF has long had a reputation as a more moderate outfit ready to work with business. That may have drawn Robertson, a Republican, to the group. But make no mistake, EDF has been at the forefront of aggressive policy advocacy in recent years, often with work that bolsters the Obama administration's agenda. Like Nat Simons, Robertson stays far out of the spotlight. Now in his 80s, he was once known as the Wizard of Wall Street for his uncanny investing skills. These days, Robertson places philanthropic bets, and beyond giving millions to curb climate change, he's put big money behind education reform. In the past 15 years, Robertson's foundation has been deeply involved in two very contentious and political education battles. First, it backed efforts under Mayor Bloomberg to overhaul New York City's public schools and to dramatically expand the number of charters. Next, it supported Michelle Rhee's expensive push in Washington, D.C. to create a new teacher evaluation system, and also poured money into expanding the number of charter schools in that city. The Robertson Foundation has also supported key education reform groups at the national level. Robertson isn't as well known as other education reform donors, but his giving underscores just how much new money has lately gone to a muscular philanthropy aimed at changing education policies, an area worth returning to for a moment as we focus on how donors bankroll advocacy. As with the environment, more donors with more money have embraced more aggressive approaches to affecting change in America's schools. One academic study found that two of the top education funders, the Gates and Broad Foundations, more than doubled their giving to national advocacy groups between 2005 and 2010, with such giving rising to $60 million in the latter year. It has only climbed since then, with Walton also giving more funds to think tanks and advocacy groups as it ramped up its overall education-related giving to over $200 million a year by 2014. Education funders have been very strategic in linking advocacy to their nuts and bolts work of creating new education institutions and practices. For example, Walton has spent the bulk of its education dollars on actually building charter schools, but it has also worked to create a policy climate where charters are embraced. Education funders have also invested in media, giving a wide array of grants for reporting on these school issues. As mentioned earlier, grants by Broad and other funders went to the Los Angeles Times to cover education in that city. This funding has been modest compared to the $10 million that the Gates Foundation has given to support Education Week, the premier source of news on K-12 issues, or the $25 million in grants it made to National Public Radio and Public Radio International over many years for reporting on both education and global issues. In 2015, many of the top education funders came together to support an online news site on education, founded by Campbell Brown, the former CNN anchor turned education reformer. The site hit the ground running with a reported $4 million annual budget. Nearly every day it's banging the drum for charter schools and other reforms. Do the consumers of education reporting know that it is supported by funders with a strong point of view who are behind that news? Sometimes yes, often not. Funders in other issue areas have also invested heavily in media, in ways that complement their advocacy giving. Green donors have scaled up a number of media outlets, such as Grist and Inside Climate News, that are sounding the alarm about threats to the planet. The Google billionaire Eric Schmidt, along with his wife Wendy, have been big backers of such environmental journalism, as has the Swiss billionaire Hans-Jörg Wies. Healthcare funders have given millions for reporting in their area, too. The Robert Wood Johnson Foundation has given over $10 million to National Public Radio since 2008, even as NPR covers highly charged healthcare battles where the foundation is a key combatant, as the biggest funder promoting the Affordable Care Act. The Ford Foundation has bankrolled media outlets like the Los Angeles Times and Minnesota Public Radio to explore inequity in American life, which is also a major focal point of Ford's advocacy funding. Most recently, new philanthropic dollars have gone to underwrite reporting on criminal justice, and other issues have gotten attention too. The PBS affiliate in New York City landed a grant of $3.5 million from the Arnold Foundation for a TV series that sounded the alarm about America's pension crisis, only to return the money after critical reporting on the gift by David Sirota. That episode was unusual. Although you might think that a rising flow of so much interested money to major media outlets would attract scrutiny, this hasn't been the case. The larger point here is that when it comes to influencing policy and public opinion, funders are pulling every lever they can think of. Many are rich enough to pull them all at the same time. Bringing it all together. If you want to see a prime example of how the different tools of philanthropic influence can change policy in one state, North Carolina is a great place to look. And Art Pope is the donor there to watch. I believe in trying to make North Carolina a better place for its citizens, Pope has said, in describing his years of philanthropy and political advocacy in that state. It's hard to argue with that sentiment, but many in North Carolina would hotly dispute Pope's vision of what better means. In 2016, nonprofits and elected leaders, backed by Pope, helped engineer the passage of a controversial law requiring transgender people to use bathrooms that match the sex on their birth certificate. The move triggered an uproar that cost North Carolina tens of millions of dollars in lost business. More about the bathroom bill in a moment, but first, a little about Art Pope. Pope was born in Fayetteville, North Carolina, the son of an entrepreneur who built a corporate retail wholesaling business out of a few small stores after World War II. Pope studied law, eventually taking over the business, as well as becoming chairman of a family foundation that he established with his father, John Pope, in 1986. The foundation funds a number of traditional causes, such as the arts, higher education, and human services, but it also devotes itself to supporting the ideals of free enterprise and limited government. "It's not enough to give a man a fish or even to teach a man how to fish," Pope has said. "We have to have a right to fish, to own the fish we catch, to sell the fish. We need a free market economy under the rule of law." Pope has explained his foundation's push into policy as being aimed at creating a more robust pluralism in his state, a familiar logic for controversial philanthropy, as we've seen. "We did not have much of a public policy debate in North Carolina," he said in 2013. "We needed a voice for those policies consistent with a free society." Pope's strategy was simple enough. He created, at a state level, the same kind of policy network that conservative funders like Richard Mellon Scaife and the Kochs had built up nationally. Over the past quarter century, the John William Pope Foundation has given more than $60 million to finance a set of conservative institutions that have helped push North Carolina to the right and made Pope one of the most influential people in the state. One of the groups it created is the John Locke Foundation, which produces a stream of research and analysis aimed at influencing state-level policy on everything from taxes to health care to transportation. Another top Pope grantee, Civitas, plays a similar role, while the North Carolina Center for Constitutional Law uses legal strategies to advance conservative ideas. The Pope Foundation also finances centers that seek to reform education at all levels and to change policy on social issues like abortion and LGBT rights. The Foundation's main grantee, working on social issues, has been the North Carolina Family Policy Council, NCFPC, a small nonprofit in Raleigh. Among the group's various priorities over the years has been fighting an expansion of LGBT rights as part of its broader battle to retain the Judeo-Christian values that are the foundation of Western civilization. In 2014, the Pope Foundation gave the council $150,000, or about a third of its total budget. In June 2015, it reportedly donated another $100,000 to the group, including $50,000 earmarked for NCFPC's 2016 voter guide. Such guides, carefully written to be nonpartisan but clearly taking a point of view, are among the many ways that nonprofits and the donors that back them seek to legally influence elections. NCFPC was strongly opposed to transgender people using bathrooms of their preferred gender and celebrated when House Bill 2 was passed in March 2016 after the city of Charlotte adopted a transgender-friendly bathroom ordinance. During the ensuing uproar over the law, NCFPC became its main defender, pumping out statements and blog posts